Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Greetings. You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. I'm Cody Cook, and I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Gary Chartier as my guest. And as far as I can tell, this is your first time on the Libertarian Christian Podcast, Gary. So it's a real privilege for me to be the first to welcome you here. I think that's true. I did check our archives, and I don't see a previous interview.
No, I believe that's correct. Thank you very much for the invitation. Great to be here.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of surprising you haven't been on before, actually. And Doug had introduced us, and so I know you've had some contact with him, but. Yeah, so Dr. Chartier, for those who aren't familiar, helps organizations and individuals explore and resolve issues related to ethics, identity, meaning, and mission. He's the Distinguished Professor of Law and Business Ethics and Associate Dean of the Zappara School of Business at La Sierra University, and the author, co-author, editor, or co-editor of around 20 scholarly and popular level books, by my count. One of them is Christianity and the Nation State, a study in political theology, and that's a more recent one. It's one that we're going to be discussing today. So thank you, Dr. Chartier, for making time to talk with us.
Absolutely. So I can either call you Mr. Cook or you can call me Gary. I think I'd go for the latter.
Okay. I'll call you Gary. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So before we kind of get into the weeds, sometimes it's good to just kind of lay a base. Could you start by giving me maybe the elevator pitch description for the book?
Absolutely. So the book is an attempt to, I guess I would say, challenge two kinds of views that I think probably have some currency among Christians today. And it's not organized in an explicit way, you know, with a kind of explicit focus on challenging those views, but I think that's really the underlying theme. So one of those is, in some broad sense, Christian nationalism. And I realize that's an expression that gets used in a lot of different ways, but I guess I take nationalism to be the view that, broadly speaking, geographically and culturally cohesive groups should have their own states. And so Christian nationalism attempts to provide a Christian rationale for that, and perhaps to see it as in some way supportive of Christian goals. So Christian nationalism is one kind of thing I'm challenging. On the other hand, I'm also challenging at different points what I sometimes perhaps too snarkily called the religion of the New York Times, and the kind of identification on the part of obviously a rather different group of Christians from those who embrace Christian nationalism, the identification of those Christians with a sort of, what would you say, sort of center-left establishment view in the U.S. and Britain and so forth. And I think both of those views, while they might be embraced by people sincerely for perfectly good reasons, seem to me to be pretty questionable. And so what I try to do instead is to argue against nationalism of all sorts, and therefore implicitly against Christian nationalism in the first chapter, and then to go on to argue against state authority and for a kind of pluralist political order in the second and third chapters before going on in the final chapter to talk about how I think Christians might responsibly engage with the actual states we've got right now. So that was longer probably than a real elevator pitch should have been, unless we're really going to the top of the Empire State Building, but
maybe Trump Tower.
Yeah.
Well, there's kind of a, maybe, how do you want to say this? Like kind of a doctrinal position of kind of what the ideal would be, but then also something a little more pragmatic.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
We live in a world where there are lots of states. We can't just wish them away.
So you open with a quote that I thought really interesting from Emil Brunner, a theologian.
Yeah.
He says, "The church, the community of believers, cannot understand itself and its task in the world without having its own view of the meaning and the function of the state." that was interesting, that the church can't really define itself unless it defines the state. So how would you, you know, sort of answer that question and thus understand what the church is?
Yeah. So I'm not finally sure, just as a biographical matter, what Bruner will have had in mind at a deep level there. But it is certainly right that in the world as we find ourselves, we who are committed participants in the life of the church have to understand that the church confronts other social institutions, a range of social institutions of which the state is only one, but of which the state is a particularly important and influential one because it plays in today's world such an important part in just kind of shaping the environment within which other social institutions function. So I think while the church seems to me to be, if you will, more important than the state, more fundamental than the state, of course, in the life of anyone who wants to not kind of idolize any human institution, but rather try to step outside the world of those institutions in a you know, in a worshipful way that recognizes our creatureliness in relation to God. The church is fundamental in a way that the state isn't, but just as a pragmatic matter, I think it's vital to be aware of what the state's up to and to respond accordingly. Bruner, I think, might well have had in mind a more exalted view of what the state was up to than I do. I think he probably thought that the state was a kind of fundamental divine order, that's the way Lutherans would often, classical Lutherans like Bruner would tend to think about this. I don't, but I think, you know, just as a pragmatic matter, Bruner's certainly right that if we ignore the state, we do so at our own peril because it plays such a crucial role in shaping, you know, the context for everything we do.
Well, and so as I kind of think about that question, people who've listened, you know, to me talk for a little bit know that, you know, my own kind of theological camp is more in the Anabaptist realm. And so I've been really looking at, you know, that kind of Reformation and Radical Reformation approach to Christendom. And is that kind of part of the question? Is it like, you know, are the two kingdoms, are they separate? Are they related? Are they integrated? Is that kind of what do you think he's getting at?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, Bruner, I take it as a Lutheran. He's got the idea that, you know, the sort of traditional Lutheran view, which you find certainly at least in places in Bonhoeffer as well, is this idea that there are, you know, so-called mandates or orders which shape created life. And the state is one of those, right? So it's certainly not a view that embraces a kind of totalitarian view of the state's capacities or you know, responsibilities, but it sees the state as occupying a divinely ordained space that it's supposed to fill in a, you know, in a responsible way. You know, certainly writing at the time he was writing, Bruner will not have been oblivious to the potential for real abuses there. And yet at the same time, I think there's still the idea going back to the Reformation era that, you know, the magisterial reformers, that indeed, you know, God has sort of placed the state in the world to do good things. I mean, it's a kind of elaboration of what you might see as going on in Romans 13. You know, the state is there as a sort of divine agent to keep order in the world. And so I think, yeah, I think Bruner's probably got that underlying view. And the church and state might be, typical Lutheran view again, in tension, but you know, it's certainly not the case that they're necessarily that either one sort of excludes the other.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Well, and so, and you give in the book, I think, two kind of distinct definitions for politics that I think we sometimes can get confused. And I thought it was kind of helpful that there's sort of one definition of politics that's more positive or at least neutral.
Uh-huh.
Another definition that I think you would define as negative. So what's the kind of the positive politics and what's the negative politics?
Yeah, that's a really important question, Cody, because I think we can think about politics as a matter broadly of social influence, or we can think about politics as a matter of using force. And you know, in any organization, there might well be politics. In any organization, there might be attempts to organize responses to things, to get people together, to accomplish shared tasks, and to affect the drift of the organization, and so forth. By contrast, we hope force is a lot more limited. States, of course, have traditionally been understood as entities that claim monopolies of force and that try to arrogate to themselves the authority to determine who gets to use force and who doesn't, and to use most of that force themselves. I think there's nothing problematic, and indeed often something quite positive, about cooperative action of one kind or another to achieve shared goals in one's community or in an organization. I think while I'm not, as you will gather from the book, I'm not in principle a pacifist, and in that way, you know, might differ with friends in the radical Reformation tradition. I'm deeply suspicious about the use of force, especially systemic force. And I think one of the things that I focus on as most mischievous about states is the tendency in which they exhibit to engage in the widespread and deeply destructive use of force. So, yeah, there's a kind of politics I think we ought to be happy about, and there's a kind of politics that we ought to view with considerable skepticism.
So would it be fair to say that there's, you know, when people are living or working together, there are, you know, you have sort of an organization or a system that develops, and politics in one sense is just kind of figuring out how to maneuver through that system and make it work. Whereas there's another definition that's sort of like the application of force against peaceful people to achieve acquired ends.
Yeah. Make them do what you want. Yeah. I think that's a really important distinction. And we want, I think, you know, it feels a little arrogant of me to say we want as Christians. I don't want to start telling everybody what to think and what to do. But certainly my own view is that it's really important to resist the temptation to use force. And peaceful voluntary cooperation makes for a thriving society. I try to show in the book why force is problematic in multiple ways and why its use ought to be very carefully cabined by focusing on multiple dimensions of what's problematic about it. So,
well, there's a quote that I jotted down. You wrote, "Christians can seek to foster the flourishing of society without seeking to rule." And one thing that's kind of interesting, I mean, comes to mind, I think it's at Matthew 21 about the don't be like the Gentiles who
Lord over. Yeah.
And so I guess, you know, one question that I find interesting, and this is kind of a perennial debate between, you know, Anabaptists like myself and Reformed people, within the libertarian movement, is what Christians are supposed to be doing, even if we sort of are assuming that we're trying to move towards something a little bit more more libertarian society.
Yeah.
Is there still like a distinction, do you feel like, between, so if we were to build this libertarian society, could Christians participate in every level of that, and then in the organization of it, and whatever kind of enforcement of private contracts, whatever kind of, because it does seem that part of, even if you get rid of the state, some kind of violence ends up becoming, I think, maybe necessary in the functioning of society in regard to defense, self-defense, or whatever. But you don't necessarily take a pacifist position. So I guess I'm curious, is in your ideal society, would Christians be able to participate in every level of it, or would there be certain places that would be inappropriate?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I don't zero in on that question In the book, you've rightly noted, right? So, I mean, I talk about sort of general kind of themes that I think are important with regard to what I think would be a peaceful, voluntary society. And then I talk about, given the implicit contrast between that kind of society and the sort we have now, what is Christian participation in contemporary political life look like? But you rightly ask, well, okay, suppose we actually moved past rule by the state with its level of, aggressive violence and so forth. What would happen if we were talking instead about, a genuinely peaceful society? So obviously, my own natural law view allows, in the context in which you talk about in the book, for some uses of force, as I think consistent with the best understood set of moral requirements. And so I think it seems to me in those cases it would be appropriate for Christians to participate there. On the other hand, it doesn't follow, because we've gotten rid of the state, that any and all institutions are going to function well. And I think there would still be questions about it that you'd have to ask as a responsible person about how to participate in a given institution, given what it's actually doing. That is to say, I don't think we could assume that force would always be deployed in what I would regard as a just manner and so forth, just because big monopolistic institutions had been eliminated. So critical thought wouldn't be obviated. I hope there would be fewer occasions when there would be real conflict between participating in kind of order maintenance institutions and Christian morals than there are now, than the conflicts that obtain now, because the opportunities for abuse would, I hope, have been reduced. I don't think they'd be eliminated.
Okay, interesting response. Thank you. So, I was anxious about mispronouncing your name, but I've got another word here that I'm actually more anxious about mispronouncing. So you suggest, as an alternative to the state, that kind of centralized monopoly on violence, a model that you call consociationalism. Did I say that right?
You said it absolutely right. So, okay. I chose the term consociationalism. Maybe this was self-indulgent. I don't know. I chose the term because it's a term that has some roots in Reformed political theology from the 17th century, and I wanted a certain kind of Christian reader to note the what might seem some familiarity there, to feel less threatened by what I was suggesting. So, a consociational approach to political life. I suggest, the sort of classical Reformed view often was, let's sort of nest social institutions within each other with respect for the autonomy and decision-making capacity of those institutions at different levels. They might be, in the Reformed era, in the era of right after the magisterial reformation gets underway. I mean, maybe we're talking about nesting free cities within, territories that are themselves parts of kingdoms that are integrated into empires. There's the idea of this, sort of Matryoshka doll model of political institutions. When I say radical consociationalism, the big difference is that while I agree with the Reformed consociationalists about the value of pushing responsibility down as far as possible in a way that's something like, Catholic principle of subsidiarity. The difference, the really crucial difference, of course, is that I want to deterritorialize that responsibility. That is, nobody has a territorial monopoly over the use of force. Rather, in the radical consociationalist model that I'm envisioning, people are participants in networks, which might be such that they link people across wide territories with, you know, different people in the same general area affiliated with multiple networks of for order maintenance in the broadest sense. And it doesn't have to be the case that the same network is responsible for law and for dispute resolution. You might have one entity that determines, you know, what laws we're following if we're part of the network, and another entity that enforces those, but you might think of those as the same. And I offered, you know, the example that you might expect people to, some groups of people to want to be governed by Catholic canon law or by Jewish law or by Muslim law. Religious law certainly might be, reborn as a guide to social order. The difference, of course, being that the deterritorialized model means it's easy to exit a network that, for one reason or another, you don't consent to. And then, you know, what I envision, and I think people have worked out these details in what seem to me plausible ways over time. Networks don't want to expend money and so forth and human resources on costly violence. They're going to want to minimize conflict, which means that when there are conflicts across networks, networks are going to have the equivalent of, you know, the sorts of agreements that obtain now between, say, U.S. states or between various countries about how cross-border disputes are going to be resolved. It's just that instead we're talking about disputes that might actually take place between neighbors who are affiliated with different networks and who might therefore initially wonder, well, can we actually resolve our dispute easily? Well, it's going to be very much in the interest of the networks to find agreeable ongoing mechanisms that allow for peaceful, you know, in the end, efficient interaction. So that's the kind of model that I have in mind. Consociationalism builds on this Reformation era model, but is deterritorialized and rooted in consensual networks.
Well, and it sounds like there's kind of some different components here. So one term that comes to mind, maybe you can tell me if you feel like this is related, is Abraham Kuyper, the Reformed thinker's view of sphere sovereignty. That you don't necessarily have, you know, not everything goes to one, you know, central power authority. You have the family and you have different aspects of society. But there's other aspects there too, this kind of idea of polycentric law, perhaps.
Yes.
You don't necessarily have one central, arbiter of kind of law.
If I can just interrupt on that point, the issue of having a kind of reliable arbiter is something that often is invoked as a source of concern about polycentric models. And I don't think this is a knock down, drag out response to that. But I would say that the system as a whole is the reliable arbiter. It's not, you know, that is, there's reason for the system as a whole to kind of find an equilibrium and a set of relationships among the different participants in which there's an emerging consensus on how to resolve those cross-network disputes. So it's not that you don't have a reliable arbiter, it's just that the reliable arbiter isn't an individual human or, you know, one particular human organization. Rather, it's the whole set of networks.
So when we talk about, law, maybe like I'll put it with a capital L.
Yeah.
That's an emergent characteristic, quality
of
these various systems.
100%.
So, and I think I'm open to that. I think that's truer than many critics would say. But there's a little part of me, like when you bring up, you know, Sharia law or something as one kind of system that someone might be under, is, you know, there's a part of me that says, well, shouldn't there be sort of a sense of natural law that's kind of, you know, if I want to live in an Amish community, I understand there's certain rules I'm going to follow, but they can't, like, you know, just stone me, right, or something, you know, because I don't go along with some ideas. So, I mean, I think that's part of the concern that some would raise is, shouldn't there be some kind of a natural law that's sort of centered, and then you sort of have these other systems maybe to deal with some of the application of that?
Okay, so I'm a natural law person. I'm an enthusiastic yeah. proponent of natural law ethics, and I've written about that in several different contexts. I've tried to develop pretty recently in my book Loving Creation, a model of Christian ethics that combines the sort of Protestant ethic of love with the Catholic ethic of natural law, and try to show how they can sort of mutually kind of interpret and reinforce each other. I agree 100% that some systems of law are better than other systems, and some systems of law are profoundly unjust, and people are unwise, let us say, to affiliate with some systems rather than others. What I don't think, however, is that there's any obvious mechanism for ensuring that everybody goes along with what I think is, you know, the right way to think about natural law. In other words, I think the most effective long-term way of moving toward the widespread embrace of something like the kind of natural law approach I would want to endorse seems to me to be one in which there are alternatives on offer, and the better alternatives have the opportunity to display what makes them worthwhile. People can see the value that they have to offer, and the main thing that I think would be sort of minimally expected of everybody in this kind of setting would be the freedom to exit, right? I mean, I think it's easier to make that possible than it is to insist that each legal system embrace all of the elements of what I would regard as an optimal natural law arrangement. Just saying people can leave, while there are obviously folks who don't want to let dissenters leave, it's at least a little easier to make that case and to defend it. And that, in turn, I think, puts pressure on individual systems to respond to what it is that might make people leave, and to take on board the information provided by the other legal systems that are on display. I don't think there's any straightforward, simple way of getting around the problem you've raised. I agree that it's a problem. I think there are going to be dodgy legal systems that would obtain over the short term, but I also think any attempt to sort of prevent them from happening from the top down is going to then create other problems and just get us back into the lap of the state.
Yeah, there's definitely some tension there.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone, it's Doug from LCI. As you may know, the team at Podsworth Media has worked with us for a long time, producing our content for most of the Christians for Liberty Network. A big part of that over the past couple of years has been using the Podsworth app to make our audio sound clean, level, and professional, even when the raw recordings were super sketchy, like this one you're listening to right now. Believe it or not, this recording was that bad before I ran it through the Podsworth app, and you can hear the full before and after demo yourself at podsworth.com. The app recently got a huge update, and it's now better than ever. So good, in fact, that it can take almost any atrocious voice recording and make it sound great. Here's how it works. It removes background noise, cuts down on plosives, fixes clipping when your gain is too high, removes clicks and pops, reduces reverb, improves tone, and levels out the dialogue so that you don't get any crazy volume jumps. Everybody hates that in a podcast. Using it is super simple. You just go to podsworth.com and click Get Started, drag and drop the audio files, open them right up from your phone's browser, customize your settings however you want. But honestly, the default works great for most settings. And here's the really cool thing. If you enter code LCI50, you'll get 50% off your first order. No account needed, just your email and payment. You'll get a download link in your inbox with cleaned up files. It's perfect for podcasts, YouTube videos, sermons, audiobooks, you name it. If your recording sounds rough, the Podsworth app can make it not only sound listenable, but professional. And remember, when you use code LCI50, you get half off your first order, and you'll also be supporting the work here at LCI.
Just to maybe kind of put a fine point on the consociationalism idea. There's a metaphor that you use that humans aren't atoms, where we can sort of identify them by one sort of identity marker, but they're more like molecules. I'd be interested to kind of hear just kind of a minute on that, and how that relates to this idea of sort of overlapping relations, kind of overlapping networks that, you know, instead of just sort of having one centralized authority.
Yeah, absolutely. So molecular rather than atomic view of persons I owe to my longtime friend Sheldon Richman, So shout out to Sheldon, who gave me that way of talking about this. You know, it's a long time criticism of the liberal tradition in politics on the part of communitarians, Hegelians, others that, oh, what you've offered up is atomistic individualism. You just imagine people existing in isolation from each other. They're disconnected from each other. They're independent of each other. They just sort of drift into brief relations with each other and then drift off again into their splendid isolation. And it's a very, I think, not very attractive view of people. And it's also just not accurate as a depiction of what life in society is like. And indeed, if we think about the roots of the spontaneous order tradition in social theory that we find, say, in the Scottish Enlightenment, a tradition that plays a really important part, I think, in liberal politics and in the kind of, view that I lay out in this book. It's a view that's very serious about our life in society. It's not at all a view that somehow seeks to cut us off from society. But I guess what it is, on my view, is a view that rejects the use of force as the sort of primary basis for getting people to cooperate in society. It's a view that emphasizes the importance of consent to participation in various associations. It's not that we don't want associations. It's that it ought to be possible to exit associations. And so that's what I'm really trying to emphasize with regard to this distinction between atomic and molecular views of persons. You highlight a connection that way of talking has with something else that I say that I think is really important, namely that we're in a social environment right now in which it's become very popular to seek to show what people's identities are in relation to their membership in various groups. And the group memberships can be of all sorts. They might be social classes for Marxists. They might be ethnic groups. They might be gender groups. They might be sexual orientation groups and so forth. But characteristically, we find people highlighting particular specific groups that they or others belong to and treating those specific groups as identity constitutive. And what I want to suggest is that we almost always are affiliated with many different groups that play, to use a currently popular term, intersectional roles in shaping our identities and experiences. And so, ultimately, I think we make choices as particular persons. We have identities that are not reducible to group memberships because we are the particular uniquely situated persons we are. But in addition, to the extent that we do gain senses of ourselves from group memberships, it's important to recognize that those group memberships are multiple. And you have Walt Whitman saying, "I contain multitudes," but I think that's true of all of us. And we all are affiliated with different kinds of identity constitutive groups with relationships that help to make us who we are. And it's just important to recognize how complex that is and not to assume that there is a kind of simple box that we can be dropped into.
Sure. I think listeners of the Libertarian Christian podcast could agree with you there. Well, and I think that this critique of atomization often comes from nationalists, right? And I think what's interesting about your response is that they're sort of saying, well, we're against atomization because we want an approach that it's not about the single person, it's about the community, it's about the unit, the nation, or whatever.
Yeah.
Another kind of atomization. It's saying that everybody is the same. And there's really only one relationship that defines all of us.
Right. And we're defined over against all those other people whose primary difference from us is affiliation with some other national group.
Right. And so what you're saying, the molecular idea is it's not just a rejoinder to a certain kind of atomized individualism, but also an atomized nationalism.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's brilliant of you to see that. And I think you see that more clearly than I do in the book. So thank you for that.
Oh, great, great. Awesome. Well, that's why these conversations are so great, right? It's not the book, the conversation doesn't end when the book is printed.
100%.
So, obviously there's a connection here. Well, once we've sort of undermined this idea of kind of one identifier, that this relationship to the nation state, there's a lot of things that can go to the wayside that lose their moral authority, things like nationalism, war, draconian immigration policies. And I want to kind of get to, one of the things that you say is that the kind of classical liberalism that you're defending is strongly tethered to what's called cosmopolitanism. And so my question is, what is cosmopolitanism and why do many right libertarians reject it and see it as in some sense antithetical to libertarian ideas? And maybe to put a finer point on it, doesn't liberty include the freedom to be racist and live in a segregated community if I want to? So isn't cosmopolitanism an imposition on my liberty?
Yeah. So, cosmopolitanism, I take it, is a view that recognizes that each of us is connected with a wider world and doesn't sort of reduce who we are to particular national or local identities. So I think that there are absolutely libertarians and folks on the right and probably some folks on the left as well, who worry about the way in which cosmopolitan language has been used to justify international practices and institutions and movements that have been authoritarian, bullying, militarist, and so forth, right? So, the consensus of, quote, the international community is that it's important to do X or Y or Z, and a cosmopolitan view for some people, I think, is a view that supports, the coalition of the willing, invading Iraq or, we think of some other examples, but I think that's the sort of thing that I think quite reasonably worries people across the spectrum about some uses of cosmopolitan language. And I absolutely don't support that that kind of approach. I certainly don't think that what we need is to beef up the military and economic power of a bunch of international, kind of bureaucracies and military alliances that can engage in bullying and mischief around the planet. So I reject that kind of cosmopolitanism entirely. The cosmopolitanism I favor is one that recognizes that we're not reducible to particular local or national identities, and that we have things in common with people from multiple cultures, and we have opportunities to learn from them, to grow in relation to them, and that there are opportunities for us to flourish by interacting with them. So there's one criticism of cosmopolitanism on the part of libertarians, conservatives, and some people on the left I completely agree with. Then you mentioned another kind, which is a criticism that says, well, I don't want to embrace cosmopolitanism because I really do want the freedom to really live in a more culturally homogeneous environment, and I want to be able to exclude people. And so I guess what I want to say there is I don't want to have any legal network that I'm part of barging into your neighborhood and forcing you to accept, particular fellow residents. I don't think that's helpful. But I also think you're going to miss out in various ways by not engaging. And I think you're already missing out if you take the view that people who are different from you are for that reason objectionable. I feel like that's a certainly as a Christian, I'm really uncomfortable with that, because I think we're all created by the one God. We're all, as John 1 says, that, you know, the logos that becomes incarnate in Christ is the light that enlightens everyone. The gospel, as first century Christians understand it, includes Jew and Greek and Scythian and slave and free and so forth. And so I feel like there's something profoundly troubling about a view that claims to be, as some Christian nationalist views claim to be, Christian, while really seeing, you know, people who aren't just like me as deeply problematic and worth keeping at arm's length. So I don't want to force you to engage with people you don't engage with, but I think it feels to me like you've got a mistaken view about the worth of other people and about the potential value of interactions with them if you really want yourself to try to force homogeneity on your immediate environment.
Is cosmopolitanism the same thing or related to this idea of egalitarianism, which I think gets defined in so many different ways, but theorists like, you know, Rothbard and Mises have argued that egalitarianism is antithetical to libertarian philosophy. And I think some people have taken their cues from him and perhaps sort of trollingly maybe used it as a word to, you know, to kind of upset the libs or whatever.
Well, again, I think you got to talk about what you mean, right? Right. So when Rothbard says egalitarianism is a revolt against nature, I think he's saying views that ignore the fact that everyone is different are foolish. And that's got to be right. That is to say that each person brings different experiences, different abilities, and so forth to the table. Where I think I would want to push back is against the sort of view that says that therefore, once we recognize that gives us a reason to segregate social groups from each other. I think that the liberal tradition ought to affirm egalitarianism in these ways. It ought to affirm that we are equally God's creatures. It ought to affirm that, therefore, we've got equal moral standing and that we merit equal legal rights. And in some broad sense, at least, that we ought to enjoy equal kind of social status. It certainly doesn't mean that we ought to be forced to kind of eliminate or ignore our various individual differences. But I do want to stress we ought to be concerned with individual differences, not with the assumption that everyone who happens to be part of some particular group shares all the characteristics that somebody might attribute to that group. So I think that I guess is the I think it's important to distinguish between the sorts of egalitarianism that might be in view, and I think a view that's affirms equality of kind of moral standing, rights, and status is very different from a view that says let's eradicate differences, let's forcibly equalize conditions, and so forth. Those are different things, and. You know, I think philosophers and theologians, you know, can annoy people because they're trying to force everyone to slow down and talk about those sorts of distinctions. But I think we're never going to get past some disagreements. I'll do that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, and, you know, I think the problem with saying you're anti-egalitarian is that it sounds like you're in favor of race and social hierarchies, and some
yeah.
are.
Some are, of course. Yeah, and yeah. I think that's wrong.
Would it be more helpful to maybe kind of tap into maybe some of your thinking and writing on this and to say that to be libertarian is not to be anti-egalitarian, but to be anti-homogenous?
I love that way of putting it, right? Because I think we certainly want, what I try to do in the first chapter of this book in particular, I mean, I've talked about the issues in other contexts, but I really dwell on this in the first chapter, is to stress human variety on all levels. And I think that when in our current sociopolitical environment, people hear talk about diversity. They think that somehow what's in view is just kind of the diversity of different social groups, which are then themselves treated as if they were homogeneous. And I think that's the wrong way to think about it entirely. And that's one of the things I'm trying to emphasize by suggesting that we've all got these multiple overlapping group identities. The fact is, groups are made up of people who are often very different from each other. And social scientists show over and over again, I think, that the differences within groups can be really pronounced, even when the groups, somehow are seen as different from others. So heterogeneity, I think, is just part of human reality. If we take it seriously, it's part of the created diversity, as I suggest in that first chapter of human life. And we absolutely want to avoid any attempt to impose uniformity, forcibly or otherwise, in ways that don't take seriously just how varied God's creatures are.
Do you see as perhaps I do that Christianity entails a certain kind of cosmopolitanism? You describe cosmopolitanism in terms of creativity, discovery, and diversity, and it seems to me that the Apostle Paul saw this supranational church of Jews and Gentiles worshiping together as a necessity, partly because he values those three things. And so, I imagine if the kind of separate but equal type of Christian that we sometimes see today could go to Paul and say, well, all this one in Christ stuff sounds great on the metaphysical level, but we just feel more comfortable when the races can worship separately. I feel like Paul would have said, to use a Greek term, tough skubalon. And is cosmopolitanism a core Christian value in your mind, is in addition to being a classical liberal one?
Yes. And that's why I do try to talk about this as rooted again in creation, as rooted in the activity of the Logos. I think that you're, on my view, 100% right, that if you read the Pauline epistles, there's just no question in my mind that a really central part of what Paul is up to is a social and political project that involves the creation and maintenance of a community that demonstrates through ongoing practice the viability of a community that transcends all of the barriers and boundaries that kept people apart from each other in the ancient Mediterranean world. And if that's right, it seems to me there's no reason the same shouldn't be true now.
Sorry, I was on mute for a second there. So getting back to this kind of idea of violence a little bit and the role of the state. Sure. So, I'm a libertarian Christian, and so it makes perfect sense to me that we can have objective Christian truth without trying to force it on others through the state. But many Christians aren't convinced. They believe that any idea that's worth anything is worth being forced on others through violence. And yeah. Isn't it possible that a liberal society in practice will tend to undermine Christian values because the majority is always going to embrace narcissism and nihilism if given a chance? That's kind of the critique of one of the big critiques of liberalism is that if these values that are good, like the family or the heteronormativity or whatever, if those are good ideas, then we have to force them through the state. Otherwise, humanity is so corrupt and wicked that it's always going to sort of go toward what's destructive.
Yeah, I understand, I guess, that kind of view, a kind of view you'd get, I think, from a certain sort of, I think it would come from kind of Augustinian thinkers, probably both Catholic and Reformed. And I guess the first thing I would say is, if you really believe humanity is profoundly wicked in that way, why would you trust humans with the kind of power the state has? I mean, you don't get to somehow give an exemption to your preferred state actors if you have these deep worries about human perversity. If you believe if you have a kind of Augustinian view, that Augustinian view doesn't allow, and I understand Augustine himself was, on my view, a lot too, you know, was too sanguine about state power. But I just think that that the view, as you've articulated it, ought to be one that leads to real skepticism about state power, number one. Number two, while I'm not an Anabaptist, I certainly hope I've learned a lot over the years from people, well, like Stan Hauerwas. And I think, you know, Hauerwas, who was a great quipster, you know, said, you know, years ago, our job is to be faithful, not successful. And I think that's, there's something right about that, even if I don't necessarily agree with every aspect of what he'd think of as faithfulness. And I guess I would say, if there are good reasons to avoid using force, then if we can't always get the results we want, despite accepting those constraints, that's just part of what it is to be a good person. You can't always get what you want, you know, even when you'd clearly be able to identify some good end, because sometimes there are good ends that it's not you that can't reasonably be pursued given the means available to you at the moment. I it seems to me that's something that the Reformed and Catholic thinkers we're talking about, again, ought to recognize in other contexts. And I guess I'd say, you know, it's worth recognizing in this context.
Right. Yeah. It is. The argument's kind of strange. You know, humans are inherently wicked. So to fix that, we should give a few of our most corruptible, narcissistic, and sociopathic members a monopoly on violence.
Well, that's insane. Yes.
All right. So post-liberals, people who are, and some of these terms may not always be familiar to our audience. I want to sometimes slow down and clarify. To be post-liberal is to say that to be against the kind of classical liberal order that kind of embraces libertarians and conservatives and liberals, this idea of kind of markets and that kind of thing, markets and liberty. So post-liberals are going to who believe that liberty has failed are going to argue that we need godly people writing and enforcing laws if we want to live in a good society. But you retort, and this is a quote, that institutions of the sort that liberals favor are robust precisely because, if occupied by sinners, as they will be, they will still do good and will prove less able to do harm than ones with more power and fewer constraints, end quote. So a libertarian society then, it seems like you're saying, a libertarian society with ungodly leaders will produce more good than an authoritarian society with godly ones, or at least ostensibly nominally godly ones.
Yeah. So my only kind of caveat there is I'm doubtful on sort of prior philosophical grounds about the ability to say something intelligible that includes phrases like more good, because I think the various goods involved are often just qualitatively different and there's no way to kind of add them up and weigh them and so forth. But I think the basic point you're making is one I would agree with completely, that, you know, there's going to be profound mischief that is liable to be done by powerful social institutions that are treated as legitimately deploying violence. And it's important to note that probably more than two, but there are two separate kinds of problems here. One is that those institutions may indeed do violence on behalf of the, you know, sort of venal interests of those with power, that, you know, as you say, narcissists and sociopaths come to claim power and then use it for their benefit. But a more subtle problem that also obtains is that people who really are well-intentioned and not necessarily narcissistic sociopaths can still do lots of harm when they have lots of power, precisely because they think we're doing God's work and therefore nothing should really stand in our way. And they can then feel free to kind of throw force around and can, I think, be quite destructive in the course of doing that. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, as C.S. Lewis said, of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victim may be the most oppressive.
yeah, I think he's dead on. Yeah.
Okay. Let me see here. We're kind of running out of time, and I've got so many questions I could ask you. So I got to kind of, I got to economize here. I will ask, this because I think it's an interesting one. So you give a real life example of these kind of multiple systems of order that yeah. challenge and complement each other. And as opposed to the kind of centralized authority that we think is kind of yeah. indispensable now. And one example you give is medieval Europe. And so I'm curious, and you kind of talked about this earlier a little bit, but can you elaborate on how that provides a model for what you're describing in consociationalism? But also, I think the someone who's listening and reading might go, well, hold on a second. Are you saying that a medieval system is better than America as we have it today?
Yeah. So obviously, as somebody who says the liberal tradition, which is, you know, in its recognizable form, 250 years old, that's valuable and important. Obviously, I'm not saying, therefore, that, you know, that should somehow be jettisoned and we should find our way back to, you know, to the year 1250. At the same time, I think it's worth noting, as is highlighted in the recent book, The Medieval Constitution of Liberty, the very sort of fragmentation of authority structures in medieval Europe, sometimes along geographic lines, but sometimes not along geographic lines, did, I think historians would tend to say, helped to lay the groundwork for the later development of liberalism by preventing the emergence of kind of centralized, top-down authoritarian power. I guess I'm not a historian, and I want to be careful about claiming more than I know. My undergrad transcript says that I did a degree in history and political science, but I'm not sure that an American undergrad degree involves enough depth of exposure to anything to really mean that I'm able to comment with great intelligence on this. But I think where I saw the medieval example as relevant was insofar as there really does seem to have been some deterritorialized law and group membership that mattered for how people interacted with each other. And so even though you didn't have necessarily the technological capabilities that we do now that might have made it easier to engage. Nonetheless, even back then, it was possible for people to be affiliated with different social groups and to carry that affiliation with legal consequences with them along their journeys across the society. People are less mobile, but when they do move, they can continue to interact along the lines of those different groups. You know, in late medieval England, you've got multiple options that people have in terms of different legal systems that might include church courts, might include chancery courts, might include the king's legal courts and so forth. So again, the appeal to the medieval example is not one that's designed to support what we sometimes see today as neo-medievalism. I'm not interested in just kind of heading back to the 13th greatest of centuries, as someone said in a book some decades ago. But I think we can learn from the medieval model that having small jurisdictions and legal relationships that aren't necessarily territorially based is something that's certainly possible.
Gotcha. So it's that aspect of it that you find valuable, not necessarily medieval history. Yeah. And I mean, there is something when you read medieval history and you compare the West to the East, that there's something kind of impressive about in the West, how the church, whatever you want to say about the Catholic Church and the medieval church, is always sort of fighting for what it thinks is its proper role in society. Whereas in the East, you have this kind of Caesaropapism idea where the emperor is basically the head of the church for that, you know, that area. Uh-huh. So that fight for their, you know, to push for the church's authority, despite, you know, Christendom, I think is pretty impressive. Let me see here. We're getting so we're right about 1 hour. I'll ask you kind of a silly question, and then I'll end with a quotation that you pull from the book that I really like.
Sure.
I noticed you were positively blurbed by a number of people, but including David Bentley Hart, whom I think of as a bit of a leftist. So I wondered when I saw that, hast thou almost persuaded him to become a libertarian?
So, David, if you're listening to this, as I expect you're not, I have no illusions that you're a libertarian. David finds fairly snarky things to say about libertarians on a regular basis.
In fairness, not just libertarians.
No, not at all. He has a very barbed wit, which is one of the many things that I think makes him worth listening to and learning from. It seems to me, you'd have to ask him what he ultimately liked about the book. He actually mentioned when I asked him to do the blurb, if I was aware that he was himself working on a book on cosmopolitanism, which I didn't know. I'm not at all surprised to find him deeply skeptical about nationalism and, probably also in general about post-liberalism. Of course, his friend and quasi-mentor John Milbank has been more favorably disposed toward some kinds of post-liberalism, though certainly not the sort of right-wing American varieties. But I'm not surprised that David is where he is on that. I want to assume that what he liked about the book was the critique of violence and the critique of authoritarianism, and that he was willing to tolerate whatever he saw as deviations in other aspects of my argument because he liked those things.
Well, and probably just your brilliance in general.
You're too kind.
Well, so there was a quotation that I really loved that you quoted from, shared from Pope Gregory the VII.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I thought it was perfect. And so I'll read that, and then I'll say goodbye so you can do what you need to do for today. So the quote is, who does not know that kings and leaders are sprung from men who are ignorant of God, who by pride, robbery, perfidy, murders, in a word, by almost every crime at the prompting of the devil, who is the prince of this world, have striven with blind cupidity and intolerable presumption to dominate over their equals, that is, over mankind? To whom indeed can we better compare them when they seek to make the priests of God bend to their feet than to him who is head over all the sons of pride, and who, tempting the Son of the Most High, and promising to him all the kingdoms of the world, said, "All these I will give unto thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me," end quote. So thank you so much for talking with us, Dr. Chartier. Where can folks find the book, and where can they follow you? Find out what you're doing.
So I'm glad to hear from anybody for whom this conversation has been helpful. You can check me out at GaryChartier.com, GaryChartier.net, the one resolves to the other. You can also find me at my La Sierra University faculty page. The book can be had wherever fine books are available, from the Cambridge website, Cambridge University Press website, of course, from Amazon, and undoubtedly from lots of other places. Because it's still in hardback, and we know how academic hardbacks are priced, I would not urge anyone who is not really committed to picking up the book, to rushing out to buy it. It's just very expensive, and I'm kind of embarrassed by how expensive it is. But check it out by all means.
Well, and maybe just kind of on that point, because there's some folks here who maybe don't do well with academic writing or whatever, or maybe want to get something that's a little more inexpensive to start with, or something more popular level. Is there anything you would recommend, some of your work that you feel does cover some of this material and introduce it, but in a more popular, digestible format?
Well, so there's nowhere else where I've really tried to grapple with the theological and the political issues together. Mm. So that, I think, is fairly distinctive here. But on the one hand, the political issues are addressed in a more, maybe kind of op-ed style in an earlier book called The Conscience of an Anarchist. We know there are lots of other books in American political life with the conscience of in their titles. And so I thought this would be one to use for provocation. And some of the theological issues I've tried to address in other places, certainly the book Loving Creation, which kind of lays out my more general approach to theological ethics, is certainly less expensive even in hardback than this one. And the kind of little systematic theology that I've done in a couple of editions, the analogy of love, is also less expensive. Whether those books are more accessible, I leave it to readers to judge. But I'm happy to hear from people and, happy to be helpful through this work if I can be.
Well, I'll link to all of them in the show notes, as we say in the biz. And I want to thank you, Dr. Gary Chartier, for your time and for a really intriguing book and a really intriguing conversation.
It's an honor to be featured on the podcast. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.